To start things off, Gary Schroen, a 35-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency. As a CIA officer, he was one of the first into Afghanistan after 9/11. In fact, 2 days after the 9/11 attacks, he agreed to walk away from his retirement, which was coming up in just a short while afterwards, and lead a group of seven men into Afghanistan, a team called Jawbreaker, guys who had expertise in everything from weapons to medicine to communications, everything. And they went into Afghanistan, and for a month, they were the only Americans fighting with the Northern Alliance to help take down the Taliban. Gary Schroen has written about it now in a book called First In, an insider's account of how the CIA spearheaded the war on terror in Afghanistan, and he joins me now here on KMOX. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Paul. It's good to be with you.
Nice to have you on here. You know, when I mentioned that you were just a short time before your retirement, I think of every cop movie cliche where there's the tough, grizzled officer who, you know, I'm retiring in 5 days, but you're sticking me with a new partner and we're going to go into and stare death down against some horrible criminal. That's what you did, right?
Well, that's exactly what I did, Paul. Thank you.
Now, when they came to you and said, hey, we want you to go and do this, was 9/11 the reason you said yes?
Frankly, that there would have been no way I would have turned it down, regardless if 9/11 had happened or not. But having watched those towers fall, just like every other American, I was anxious to try to do something against bin Laden and that group of terrorists. And to be offered to take the first team into Afghanistan and start that war was just something that I could not ever have said no to.
Having worked that part of the world and being at Langley that day and seeing the second tower being hit and then the towers falling on 9/11, did you know instantly that it was Al-Qaeda?
When we all stood around watching the television, because word had come down from the CTC, our counterterrorist center, that the World Trade Center had been hit. When the second plane hit, though, we knew instantly that it was the work of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. That's his trademark, multiple attacks, close together, and then word came of the other hijacked aircraft that day, and we all knew that it was bin Laden.
All right, so when they brought you on board and you put a team together, you and six other guys were going to go in there into Afghanistan, is because Afghanistan and the Taliban regime there had been the prime supporters of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, right?
That's correct. The U.S. put a lot of pressure on the government of Sudan back in early 1996, and that was where bin Laden was established pretty firmly. And they eventually, in May of that year, threw him out, and bin Laden went to Afghanistan where the Taliban welcomed him, and he became an honored guest there.
So what were your marching orders?
Pretty simple. First was to go in and join the Northern Alliance, which was the group of Afghan Tajiks fighting the Taliban, the last armed group really resisting the Taliban, and get them to fight with the U.S. military in concert with us. And then the second order was very clear. Once the Taliban were broken and we had access to the country, we were to find bin Laden and his lieutenants and kill them.
In fact, it was even stronger wording than that. Kofor Black, who was the head of the Counterterrorism Center at the time, said, I don't want bin Laden and his thugs captured. I want them dead. Alive and in prison here in the United States, they'll become a symbol, a rallying point for other terrorists. They've planned and carried out the murder of thousands of our citizens. They must be killed. I want to see photos of their heads on pikes. I want bin Laden's head shipped back in a box filled with dry ice. I want to be able to show bin Laden's head to the president. I promised him I would do that. Have I made myself clear? That's what Kofor Black said to you, right?
As close word to word as I could remember it.
How come we don't have Osama bin Laden's head on dry ice?
That's a good question. Primarily when we started, I kind of thought that the Taliban would break fairly easily. And indeed, I think had our bombing strategy been to focus on the Taliban front lines and really pound them, as we did later, say, and after the beginning of November, we would have had time to move forward quickly before bin Laden and his guys realized what was happening. But as it was, it wasn't until the 14th of November that Kabul fell. Bin Laden had plenty of time to regroup, and he was able to stay ahead of the U.S. military and our CIA teams until the Battle of Tora Bora, when he was finally able to slip into Pakistan.
Yeah, and once he slipped into Pakistan, have we lost him?
No, I think we know the general area that he's hiding, or at least we're firmly convinced that he's in an area north of Peshawar, in what are called tribal territories of Pakistan. These are areas that are right along the border with Afghanistan, and the tribal leaders there and the tribal members hate the Pakistani government. They hate any government, and they hate America as well. And so they've welcomed bin Laden, and the Pakistani military has been very reluctant to go into those areas north of Peshawar to try to track bin Laden down.
If we had kept forces in Afghanistan instead of sending them to Iraq, something that you criticize in the book, could we have made that capture and done more damage to al-Qaeda?
I would say yes, because what we did was we were using small mobile teams of CIA and special operations units, either Green Berets, some Delta, some SEAL team members, and we were with local guys that the CIA recruited. We were moving pretty quickly along the border area. But when they began in March of 2002, those troops and a lot of the CIA guys were pulled out to go to Iraq and get ready for the war. And we had a conventional military, U.S. military, come in who weren't trained to move as quickly and in such small units. And so the fighting and the hunt for bin Laden slowed. But another problem that we faced then and we face now is the fact that the government of Pakistan won't allow us to go into their country there along that border area, and they're reluctant to do it.
Let's talk about your time there in Afghanistan shortly after 9/11. It was, what, 2 weeks after 9/11 you were in country?
Yeah, that was just about exactly, yes.
Is it possible for an American, even one who's familiar with the area, to blend in Afghanistan?
No. We, at first, our hosts, the Northern Alliance fighters, wanted us to dress like they did. And we put on, you know, the clothes from there and the hats. And there were a couple of guys who already had beards from other previous paramilitary deployments. And the first time we walked around, everybody looked at us, you know, like we were coming out of a spaceship from Mars. You know, there was no way that we could have fooled anyone that we weren't anything but Americans.
Everybody knew you're just Americans in costume.
Exactly. So we reverted to our, camping gear, American camping gear, blue jeans or camping pants and jackets and things, and felt much more comfortable.
It was funny reading the book to find out that the CIA outfit in Afghanistan came from L.L. Bean.
Exactly. we had to go out and just shop, just like if you were going on a camping trip to the Rockies, you'd go down to a local camping store, buy your stuff, and that's what we did.
Gary, as a CIA officer leading the Jawbreaker team there, what authority did you and your team have?
Basically, the agency allows officers, when you go on a mission like that, a lot of leeway, especially when you're going in completely alone, you know, behind enemy lines. I had my marching orders. I knew what we needed to do. I had $3 million in cash to dispense to cement the loyalty of the Northern Alliance leadership that we were dealing with. And our job was just to get them ready and start having them send guys across the lines to look for bin Laden while we got them ready to fight the Taliban.
Let's talk about that money for a second, because I actually laughed out loud as I was reading this passage in the book. When you talk about having $3 million, Gary's not talking about having a credit line on his Visa, his MasterCard, his American Express. He didn't have traveler's checks. You had cold, hard cash, didn't you?
Exactly, $100 bills.
In cardboard boxes?
Yes. We finally put it into a suitcase because it was a lot easier lugging it around as heavy as it was rather than three cardboard boxes full of money.
So you would take it out of the boxes and carry it around with you. How much money was walking around money in Afghanistan?
Depending on what leader we were seeing, we would run from $100,000 to $250,000 when we went out for meetings.
And how would you disperse it to them? Just at your own whim?
Basically, they would tell me the kinds of things they needed. We would talk about the priorities of their needs, and then I would decide how much money that I should give them, keeping in mind that I didn't know when I would get a replenishment of the money, so I was as frugal as I could be, trying to get maximum bang for our buck.
As a matter of fact, you ran out of the $3 million pretty fast, didn't you?
Oh, well, yeah, they had a lot of needs up front, and we were lucky enough that the Counterterrorist Center sent us another $10 million. So we were well armed with cash.
The story in the book is that a helicopter shows up to resupply you guys with some guys and with some stuff and some men as well. And on board the helicopter, they also happen to have $10 million that's in boxes, but nobody's exactly sure how much is in each box. And you guys, you just put it in an office and left it there, right?
Yeah, I put it in the corner, and they were big boxes. We figured $10 million, it takes up a lot of room. So we had four big cardboard boxes in the corner, and we just used it as a table or a place to have coffee, or you could take a nap on it. And
I don't think Donald Trump has a $10 million place to take a nap.
That's I know, he's probably not slept on a $10 million bed.
That's pretty good. These are American dollars we're talking about here. Could the Northern Alliance use our hard currency?
American dollars are the currency preferred in that part of the world. Afghan money, called Afghanis, are almost worthless. Pakistani money is useless anywhere outside of Pakistan. You can't even exchange it at an airport. So, no, the U.S. dollars was what everybody wanted.
The almighty dollar. Wow.
Absolutely.
The book is called First In, an Insider's Account of How the CIA Spearheaded the War on Terror in Afghanistan. Gary Schroen, now retired, actually had his last mission and retired safely, unlike those movie cops we were talking about earlier. He made it to the end, and we'll talk more about his story about being inside Afghanistan in those 2 months following 9/11/01 in a moment. The Paul Harris Show continues on News Talk 1120 KMOX. I'm Paul Harris talking with Gary Schroen, 35-year CIA veteran, winner of the Intelligence Cross, the highest award given by the CIA. Spent most of his career in the Middle East, in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Iran, and now writes about his insider's account of being one of the first into Afghanistan to help knock off the Taliban and go after al-Qaeda after 9/11. The book is called First In. And I got to ask you about recent stories that have come out in the last few days, Gary, about things that are going on in Afghanistan or have been going on in Afghanistan after you left there. Military interrogators torturing prisoners. A couple of prisoners died after being tortured to death in Bagram, and other problems with that going on in that country at the hands of Americans. We still have 20,000 soldiers in that country, and we, I guess, are still holding a large number of people there, and also in Guantanamo Bay, of course. What are your thoughts on the stories that have been coming out in the last few days?
Well, if they're true, it's really sad, because it will tarnish our reputation there and erode support. We were looked on by the vast majority of the people of Afghanistan as heroes for liberating them from the Taliban and allowing them to actually begin the process of having peace. If indeed, you know, our soldiers have tortured prisoners, it's really a tragedy. So we'll have to wait and see what the investigation turns up. But just as there were riots, though, in that country, after the Newsweek story of our guards desecrating the Quran, or supposedly desecrating the Quran in Guantanamo, there are a lot of people in Afghanistan who still like the Taliban fundamentalist philosophy, and something like that, if it was true, which Newsweek has retracted the story, but it did create a stir. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done there, and there's still a lot of pro-Taliban feeling, and what I'd hate to see is that switch to anti-American feeling there.
Afghanistan President Hamid Karzai was at the White House with President Bush today and was asking for more and more help from America. He wants to have Afghani commanders in charge of the U.S. troops who are serving over there. He also wants to talk about the heroin problem. They've got a tremendous problem there. The 80 to 90% of the heroin in the world is now coming out of Afghanistan, which didn't happen when the Taliban were there. If there was one thing the Taliban was good at, it was keeping this stuff from being grown there. But it's now back, and it's the biggest cash crop in that country, isn't it?
That's true. And primarily, there were two reasons. One, the war, 25 years of war, destroyed the infrastructure of the country. There are no roads to speak of. There are dirt trails, potholes, bridges are down. there's the irrigation system around the country was almost primarily destroyed by the Taliban, who purposely went in and destroyed the irrigation to punish people who weren't following them. So there's nothing for the farmers to grow that will earn them money other than poppy. And the President Karzai's plea to President Bush for more assistance is right on the mark. 1 month of what we spend in Iraq on the military operations could change the country of Afghanistan significantly and give that government a real fighting chance to survive.
Are you talking about just giving them cash or more personnel or what?
Well, they need aid, not just pouring cash in, but they need programs that can be monitored and controlled by the UN and the United States that will allow reconstruction and infrastructure to be done with minimizing the graft and corruption that would take place even there. We need more CIA people there and more special operations folks there if we're going to try to get the job done and crush this resurgent Taliban activity that we're starting to see in the press and read about, with soldiers being killed and attacks being conducted.
I was talking about the evils of the Taliban before 9/11 because of Jay Leno's wife, Mavis Leno, who I had on the show, and she was talking about how the situation in Afghanistan was for women, that it was the most oppressive place on earth, even more oppressive for women than Saudi Arabia and other places like that. And that's how I got aware of the problems over there and why I was so happy that 9/11 or not, we went in and crushed these people who I think are just evil through and through in their religious extremism. You've been back there. You went back to Afghanistan last October. What is the role of the woman there now?
It's been a dramatic change. Afghan women prior to the communist takeover in the late 1970s were very liberated women. They were well educated. They could go to school. They were dressed in Western clothing. Had good jobs, professional jobs. That was eroded under the Soviets because of the war situation. And then once the Taliban got in, I mean, they put women down to. I think they treated their goats better than they did the women. It was just horrible what they did. So, but women have come back, and they're coming along. There still is, unfortunately, a lot of fundamentalist views there that women shouldn't be allowed. There's a sad story in the paper out here today about a woman who was killed, who was a DJ on a Kabul radio station, and she was murdered by her own family for becoming too westernized.
When you were there fighting to try to take down the Taliban and get through them to Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, did the Taliban have anything that we recognize as a normal command structure so you knew who you were going after?
No. They had commanders. It was still along the Afghan guerrilla army kind of thing where they had commanders and they had groups that they had raised, groups of fighters. And then there were Arab and other foreigners who were integrated into those units, semi-integrated. They fought independently, because it was really the foreigners, the Arabs and the Chechens and other nationalities, who really held the Taliban forces together in any big battle.
When you and your CIA team, the Jawbreaker team, went in there, the seven of you, you were doing a mission that was considered too dangerous for the U.S. military, or was it that the U.S. military couldn't do it because they couldn't be covert enough?
No, we weren't too worried at that point about being covert. The U.S. military, and rightly so, wants to protect its personnel, and they wanted to have a search and rescue helicopter structure in place in the region so that they could come and get their guys should an airplane be shot down or not. We didn't, and since that didn't happen for about a month, they didn't send anyone in. The CIA operates a little differently. We just, went in anyway. We had our own helicopter. If something happened, we'd have walked out. We were there alone until we could arrange things so that the military could come in.
Did you get support from the military when you needed it?
Oh, absolutely. Once they got on the ground, these Special Forces A-teams, the Green Berets, were just outstanding. They were right down on the front lines. Our guys were down there to help them. with translation and being sure that the integration with their forces were there. And those guys were on the front lines bringing down heavy shot and shell on the Taliban positions and then getting shot at every day.
The book is First In, an insider's account of how the CIA spearheaded the war on terror in Afghanistan. Gary Schroen is the 35-year CIA veteran. Not 35 years old anymore, are you, Gary? It's been a while since that happened, since they had only 35 candles on the birthday cake.
Yeah, exactly.
But 35 years in service in the Central Intelligence Agency and one of the first into Afghanistan after 9/11. We'll come back and talk some more in just a moment. It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking with Gary Schroen, CIA veteran who was one of the first into Afghanistan after 9/11, when we went in to topple the Taliban in our efforts to get to Osama bin Laden. I've not achieved that goal yet, but he and his team did what they needed to do. And he tells an insider's account of how the CIA spearheaded the war on terror in Afghanistan in his new book, First In. There, of course, is a link to it on my website, harrisonline.com. Gary, in the book, you say the U.S. government was rash and reckless. How so?
I think that in one of the things that we did was, especially toward the end, was the moving of troops over to Iraq, and it was too soon. And what we did in attacking Iraq, while Saddam may have needed to be removed at some point, what we ended up with is a mess that we can't get out of, we're actually had created a situation that is helping to create young terrorists who are coming from all over the world to fight against us there in a cause that they see the United States attacking Islam again and by invading this Muslim country.
I think most Americans got used to short wars. After the Vietnam War, we didn't have any war that lasted more than a couple of months. Even the first Gulf War in 1991 wasn't an ongoing thing. You guys went into Afghanistan 2 weeks after 9/11, and by November 14th, Kabul had fallen, and most Americans thought, okay, well, there's another victory for us. But here we are now in the spring of 2005 with 20,000 troops still in there, and who knows how long 140,000 are going to be in Iraq. Are we not doing the mission correctly, or should we, as Americans, get used to the fact that wars don't go quickly anymore?
Well, I think that the answer is that we've fought conventional armies, and those have been defeated pretty quickly. Even if you don't call the Taliban army a conventional one, it was a strong military force, and we were able to pound it into oblivion in about 6 days. We defeated the Iraqi army. What we're having problems with is this insidious insurgency where you get these people who are fanatically dedicated to destroying us, who are willing to die and kill themselves to hurt a few of us. It's a whole totally different kind of war.
If the United States pulled out of Afghanistan right now, could the Afghanis, Karzai and his people, control their own country and defend it?
No. Not without us and not without a lot more assistance. Maybe in a couple of years, we get the Afghan army trained up completely, get their intelligence service fully up and going, a good national police service there. That'll be a couple of years at least down the line. Then they might have a chance. If we left today, no, there would be chaos there within a year. Total chaos.
Yeah, I think we're going to be there for a little longer than that, but we'll see. As a CIA veteran, you had to be embarrassed by the intelligence failures before 9/11 and the WMDs in Iraq. Was that like a shot to the heart to hear how wrong things were?
Yes, I think that in the aftermath, as people have gone back and looked at things, I think the facts, the truth was there. It's just you can interpret things, in different ways, and people were choosing at the time back in 02 to look at things from a certain perspective. It's a shame because there were no weapons of mass destruction there and all. And I think that there was evidence that CIA and other agencies had, but it just didn't. It wasn't a convincing argument made for that. So
that's got to be a killer, though. You know some of these people who were gathering some of this information, and was it that it was being twisted on the way to other people, or was the information just flat out wrong?
No, I mean, some of it was flat out wrong. We were being lied to. There's a fellow named Chalabi, who an Iraqi that he was considered by the press. New York Times magazine had a cover feature on him just about 2 months before the war started, touting him as the hero of Iraq.
Yep.
The man was a crook.
Ahmad Chalabi. He wanted to be president of the country as recently as a year ago.
Yes, and still does. And we had, CIA had dealt with him extensively during and immediately after the first Gulf War, and we just put a burn notice out on him, as we call it, saying, do not talk to this man. He's totally unreliable. He's a fabricator. And yet you had the Department of Defense and State Department looking to him because he spoke well and he wore, you know, really nice suits and could really talk a good game, depending on him. So it was his source that was the one who produced the information about weapons of mass destruction, and it was bogus.
I'm sure the CIA had to approve everything you have in the book here, but are they in on the movie deal?
No, I'm going to keep that one for myself.
It's a great read. I mean, I love first-person stories, and I love to read about the process of how things go, and this is a real terrific one. First In, an insider's account of how the CIA spearheaded the war on terrorism in Afghanistan. Thanks for your time today, Gary.
And it's good. I'm a local boy. I was born and raised in East St. Louis.
Is that right?
It's good to talk to St. Louis. And
well, thank you for being here on the Paul Harris Show. It's Gary Schroen on News Talk 1120 KMOX.